welcome to our fashion installment of She Runs the World. My name's Emily.
I'm Kai.
And in honor of the fashion issue of The Voice coming out this week, we'll be interviewing designer Deb Savini. How are you doing today?
I'm good. How are you?
Good, thanks. Deb Savini has been designing for theater in the Washington, D.C. area for over a decade and is an assistant professor of the practice in the Theater and Performance Studies Department at Georgetown University. She teaches courses in design and costume history. Off campus, she is developing new work as a member of The Welders, a D.C.-based playwrights collective, creating and creating design-driven work for a theater audience. She is a Korean adoptee, so her work with The Welders centers around the subject of adoption. She has a BA in theater design from Middlebury College and an MFA in costume design from the University of Maryland. Thank you so much for coming out today.
Thanks so much for having me.
So I've actually read a couple of your interviews, and I know you answer this a lot, but why don't you just, like, tell us how you got interested in costume design?
Okay. Like all things, it was an accident. I actually went to Middlebury wanting to major in classics and classical languages, which is why I chose a language-heavy school, but I needed a work-study job, and I'd been sewing since I was a kid, and I ended up in the costume shop. And I learned from there, it can be a career, which I had no idea. Like, everyone wants you to go to med school or law school or go into business or something. And I thought, well, I will be a linguist. And that was my life goal. And I was 18, so I didn't know better. And when I realized that, like, design could combine history and storytelling and psychology and all those things at once, it was really exciting. And I started pursuing that.
How does it combine psychology?
So it's partially about actors, depicting characters on stage, and clothing reflects pretty directly how you're feeling, why you got dressed on a certain day reflects, like, whether you're, you know, on the light side happy or sad, but also, like, what you might be feeling individually, your economics, you know, and how all that sort of affects your psyche. So that's a pretty deep field.
Yeah, that's, like, really going to give the first impression of the character to the audience. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so many, like, kind of subliminal clues about who this person is. And
absolutely.
I feel like it can really make or break the play sometimes. Like, mm-hmm. like you really, I don't know, like when the costume's good, like, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you know everything about the character. Or maybe you don't. Maybe you don't know anything about the character and the costume is that good and it gets revealed. But sometimes we tend not to notice it when it's really good. We go, oh, that's a great dress. And then our brain moves on and we get into the play. If the costume is bad, I'm stuck. I'm like, oh, the costume is bad. It doesn't fit. We really recognize, like, when something fits badly or when somebody looks bad. Sometimes it's because the character needs to look bad, but sometimes it's just not a very good costume. You're like, well, that's a poor choice. And then you're distracted for the rest of the show. At least that's what happens to me.
That's a huge responsibility. Yeah, I'd be intimidated by that.
Yeah.
Well, like, has the nature of the design industry changed over the years, or has it been relatively similar?
It's interesting. What's changed is technology. So I will show my age. I graduated from undergrad in 1999. So back then, internet, relatively new. Online shopping wasn't a thing. Like, eBay was just being invented, like, right around there. I remember when eBay came out, we were like, wow, we have access to all this stuff now? Like, before, when you wanted, like, a suit, you had to go into a store or you had to call somebody up in a catalog, or, you know, everything was by mail order, so everything was really slow. Now we have, like, Zappos will get you shoes in 24 hours by clicking a button, Amazon Prime. It's a miracle. So that it's the speed at which we can work is really the thing that's changed over the years. It's good and bad because people are like, oh, well, that character just needs a new pair of shoes. Can you get that by tomorrow? And you're like, yeah, I will. But now you can just click a button. You don't have to, like, run out to the store or wait until the mall opens. I mean, that's still part of the job, but it's in that way, it's a little bit more convenient. I would say that's the major change in the field, which is sort of revolutionary. A field that revolves largely around shopping is
a lot. Yeah, like, from, like, my very limited kind of like middle school, high school experience in theater. Mm-hmm. I feel like theater is like always in a rush. Like no matter how many hours you're putting in, like you're still somehow behind on the upcoming.
That is the truth. Yep. You really try your hardest not to get behind, you know, and I mean, I'd really love to be ahead of the game, but you do, you get there and you see it and you're like, oh, it still needs more work.
Gosh. What's your design process? Like, where do you come in during the production?
Yeah, at the beginning, usually. Sometimes the scenic designer, so the person designing, like, what they're in, house, room, no space, whatever, will come in first, and then I'll come in afterwards. But generally, lately, I've been coming in at the same time they bring in the whole team. This is, like, a given theater company, as an example. We'll bring in the whole team at the same time, and we'll sit down and we'll have a conceptual meeting with the director who's, you know, maybe talked with the playwright if the playwright is still alive, or, you know, thought out in their head and through their research how they want to approach the play. Sometimes casting's already been done, and they come in and they tell you who's going to be in it. Sometimes casting hasn't happened yet. We're trying to figure out what happens. So from there, it usually starts in a very traditional space. Starts with the director's idea for how they want to approach the play. And then sometimes they give visual ideas, sometimes they don't. Sometimes we give visual ideas. And then from there, it's just a dialogue about how we want to approach the play.
Is it easier when you know who the actors are going to be?
Oh, so much easier. Yeah, because DC theater community, I mean, yes, there are a lot of us. But on the whole, it's really small. And I've probably worked with several hundred people in this community, like, multiple times. So actors are like, oh, yeah, Deb's doing the costumes, I know that I will be taken care of, which, thank God, that is the reputation I've built, instead of, oh, no, it's Deb, what are we going to do? That I know bodies, I know actor bodies, I watch them change and morph and lose weight and get self-conscious, and they're like, I'm so sorry, I've gained 10 pounds, or I lost 10 pounds, or you get to keep up with actors and, like, their work and what they do, and you find out what they look good in from seeing other people dress them, and you just develop relationships. So knowing who the actors are on the way in is awesome, because then you kind of already know what all the quirks are going to be with them, because everybody's got quirks, good and bad.
Do you work by yourself, or do you have a team?
It varies. It depends. At some theaters, there is a shop, so there'll be a shop manager who manages many, many shows a year, and I come in as a contract worker to do the designs for that one show, and then I'm out like a month later. Sometimes I will be with a project for 6 months working by myself in the studio, slogging away, making things from scratch. Sometimes I take on an assistant who comes in and does the same thing with me, but often I'm alone. It's a pretty lonely, at least the costume design side of it, the making of the clothes, the shopping is pretty lonely.
That's a lot of work for one person. Mm-hmm. That's
Yep.
Wow, no wonder why you're so busy. That's,
yeah,
I can't imagine.
Wait, like, given all of that, like, why did you decide to come to Georgetown on top of all the work that you already do in D.C.?
Yeah, it's nice to have a home base that is steady. I mean, there's an economic reality to that, like, theater, not the most lucrative field. No one does it for the money. You do it for the love of the art. But, you know, I mean, you'd like to do it for the money, and I like getting bigger contract gigs at other places. But why I joined Georgetown, the stability of just having a bunch of colleagues that I come to work with and see every day is really, you know, really edifying for me. It gives me just a place that I can call home. Because when you're bouncing around as a freelancer at a bunch of different theaters, like, yeah, I have friends in all those places, but I'm just one other person who works at their theater with the other 100 people that they hire in a given year. So, I don't know, to work with the same 15 people and see those same faces every day is really, it's good for me, it's good for my mental health.
How is it working with student actors? Like, how does that differ from your work in, like the professional theaters?
It does differ in the way that, we're still in an educational environment here. When I work in the professional world, it's obviously would be way out of my league to educate a professional actor on, like, what I think their clothes should be. When I'm here and I'm working with students, it's sort of a careful balance of doing a little bit of teaching, especially in, like, fittings. I'll bring in an actor to try on some clothes, and I'll show them their clothes and say, you know, put these on, please. Pull a curtain so they can change. And when they come out, I can have a conversation with them about, like, do the clothes fit on a pragmatic level? But then after that, like, do these clothes support what you're doing in rehearsal? Are they good for your character? What are you doing in rehearsal that might affect how these clothes wear? Like, if they're in a dress and they're crawling on the floor, we might consider doing pants or a different kind of garment. So it's more of a, and I do similar things with professional actors, but with students, it is more of a conversation where I'm trying to elicit from them, like, what they're doing in rehearsal and how I can support them better as an actor. So it's, like, a little bit more educational than it would be when I was working with professionals who often will have a long conversation with me about what they think the character should wear. And then it's a much more open dialogue. Here you have to guide the conversation a little more.
So it's very much like a back and forth, almost like a trial and error process.
Yeah.
Gosh, does that ever get, like, really frustrating?
Oh, of course it can. Yeah, I mean, even with students sometimes, and I watch this with student designers, too, because everybody has an opinion, especially when it comes to modern clothes. So if I'm dressing a whole bunch of Georgetown students as Georgetown students, but I've done the shopping and I'm not using their wardrobes, they're like, well, I would never wear this. And I'm like, but would your character? Oh, and then it's a whole different conversation. Because, yeah, of course you wouldn't wear that. That is not the sweatpants and t-shirt you walked in with. Or it's not the Prada dress you walked in with. It's somewhere in the middle, and it's what we could afford on this budget. But I still think that this might work for the play. So there's a little bit of salesmanship that has to go into the work. Where you are convincing a person that you know what they're doing in terms of dressing their character. So if you're not... if you're a doormat about it, then they will walk all over you and they will win, you know, but I don't like turning it into a competition. It's not about who wins. It's about everybody being satisfied after you've had that conversation and it manifests itself in the clothes.
So I was looking at your website and looking at all the plays that you've done, and you've done a couple, like, classic Shakespeare plays, but also, like, newer ones. Which one do you prefer?
Oh, I love new plays. Working with playwrights that are still alive is a true gift, because they're often those places where I'll read, like, Eugene O'Neill, and he's a genius, obviously, and people are still doing Eugene O'Neill plays, but you want to be like, Eugene, what were you thinking when you made this stage direction? Like, I really wish I could get into your head. So when you're working with new plays and new playwrights who are still around, and sometimes they're even in the room, you can be like, when you wrote this scene, what was your motivation? What were you trying to get to? Because I could see it playing out one of these two ways. And you can actually talk with the playwright about what they were thinking. Or if sometimes they turn it right back around. They're like, I don't know. What do you think? And then you can figure out, you know, what they were up to.
And especially, like, in those first two performances, that's, like, still, like, developmental stages, like, foundational for the play to, like, set precedent for future performances or, like, future interpretations.
Absolutely.
That's gotta be cool. Like, you know, like, creating the play itself, really, even after it's been written.
Yeah. I've done a lot of, actually, first production. So world premieres is, like, the first play, hot off the presses. And then I've done a lot of second productions where the playwright will have the experience of coming from another theater and doing the play there with a totally different team, then they'll come into a whole other theater, and then we're the new team, and they know everything they know from the first production. Maybe they've been burned, or maybe they want to replicate something like it was in the first production, and that's an interesting challenge in itself, because you want to do your own thing, you want to be original about it, but at the same time, you do have to do what is on the page. That is, you know, what a designer answers to is ultimately, like, what is in the text that we're telling the story.
Have you ever had a situation where you have taken, like, a totally different spin from...
Absolutely.
What was that like?
It's exhilarating. Sometimes it's a notion, again, bringing up that sort of salesmanship of, like, really, no, you should let me try this idea, because I do think that we can turn this around and see it from a different perspective. Sometimes it just doesn't work out, and you have to be able to... you know, to sit back and say, okay, that did not work, but we tried. Thank you for letting me try, but we'll be all right. Because, you know, ego is on the line for every single person. I mean, and ego is a big part of it. You try not to put your ego first. I am not, It's funny. I will often joke that I have a huge ego, but I, you know, but people are like, really? I'm like, yeah. I just don't tell you about it. Because I'm like always hiding behind the, oh no, it'll be okay. Let's come to this compromise. But I know exactly what I want in my head. I'm a very decisive person. But I do know that when I'm in the room with other people, like, we have to come up with a compromise.
So with the older plays, do you try to do something new every time, or do you just like follow the original?
It's interesting. So some really old scripts, well, not even that old, some scripts in general will describe the character, costume and all, top to bottom, tell you what color they're wearing, you know, tell you what silhouette, whatever that happens to be. I actually always take that to heart to figure out, is this the description from the original production, or is this something the playwright really wants? And you can kind of tell from Google searches, thank God, of other productions of it. So I will look at that kind of stuff just to see what other people have done, and then I will turn it all off and I'll do my own research and I'll do my own thing. I'm not bothered by what other people do, nor would I ever copy what someone else did. You know, I tend to do my own thing in that way, because plagiarism, and that's bad. But I will do my own research and develop my own design without looking at what other people have done in the end. And I know that because it's sort of coming through me and my voice and my personal aesthetic, it is new, even if it sort of closely resembles what someone else did. Because, like, if you've got a show set in, like, 1915, women were only wearing 4 or 5 different silhouettes. There are 4 or 5 variations of detail. It's not, like, the vast fashion that we have now. I think if I really went down the rabbit hole, of course I would find lots of different details for that era. But there are, like, 2-3 basic silhouettes that tell you this is the era. So that's a pretty tight box to work in anyway. Mm-hmm. So I wouldn't take the show and be like, I'm going to put it in 1930, because that would be totally inappropriate. Some plays give you that flexibility, but a lot of the old classics don't.
Do you have your own style?
It's such a good question. It is a hard thing to answer, to be honest. I would describe my style, at least as a costume designer, because it's actually different when I scenic design. I'm like a different person. With scenery, I'm like super detail oriented. With costume, it's often this sort of silhouette first. So I often think about how the body is shaped with the clothes, and then I think about the fabric, and then I usually don't put any detail into it. So I have friends who do like highly trimmed costumes, will design the dress around the jewelry. I'm like, there's jewelry? Right, okay. I tend to make big, bold statements with my costumes, and I don't get hung up on like the tiny little details unless I have to. It's not laziness. It's just I'd rather say more with the silhouette and the fabric and the bearing of the character than I do with like a tiny button people will not notice from 10 feet away.
So you mentioned scenery. Like, to what extent are you designing like the fashion in parallel with the scenery? Like, so they stand out or blend in, or
yeah,
like what kind of interplay is there?
Lately I've been doing a lot of both on the same show, which has been interesting. So then I get to control all of the interplay of like especially the color palette is one of the biggest things that sort of marries scenery and costumes of like, you know, you're in a red shirt sitting against a burgundy chair right now, but your shirt has a print, so you automatically stand up from the plain fabric of the chair. And so those are choices that you can make when you're doing both that aren't like a surprise. Sometimes you get into the theater and you know, the actor will like lean up against a wall and the perfect blue shirt that you found that makes all of you happy, that makes their skin look good, and then the wall is the same color and you're like, oh no. And maybe you should have known that going in, because maybe you should have asked, but maybe you didn't. So sometimes doing both saves you the headache of matchy-matchy or things that totally clash that are kind of awful. But, you know, it's all about having, when I'm working separately, it's just about remembering to have all these conversations with the set designer and paying attention to what the set is doing. Often set takes sort of visual precedence over costumes, because you can dye a costume a different color if it's not working. You can't really, like, repaint the whole set. So it's about sort of time, money, resources, that triangle, in terms of how it all goes together.
There's so many, like, interworking pieces to mm-hmm. consider, like, things that I wouldn't have even thought of, like, to notice. That's just...
Yeah.
Yeah, like,
It's a Tetris.
So with some of the newer plays, like, to what extent, like, if at all, are you going to incorporate, like, current trends in fashion or any of that?
Yeah, it depends on your characters. It's funny, a few years ago, I worked as a stylist on top of everything else. You know, I took a little hiatus from theater and I decided that I might try my hand at fashion styling. So I did that for, you know, a sort of upper middle class clientele here in D.C. and Maryland. And had to keep up with current fashion trend, had to, you know, constantly window shop, constantly had to know what was going on in stores. It's so much to keep up with on top of, like, remembering what happened in 1602. So I stopped doing it because it was just too much. But that said, like, if a character is super current and is a shopaholic, you have to do the research to know exactly what that character should wear. So I do dip in and out of fashion all the time. Because, yeah, if you're not on trend, especially here at Georgetown, like, if you're depicting someone who is a student in this moment, you better know what that looks like, because your whole audience is students who are going to come and judge that character and maybe judge that actor for, like, not being right. It wasn't their choice, it was mine. So it's a kind of a vulnerable place to be if you're trying to, like, depict life. It's a different balance.
Actually, yeah, that's a really interesting point about Georgetown, because I feel like our campus, more than other college campuses, people are very aware of mm-hmm. appearances yeah. and, like, what they're wearing and the fashion. Like you don't go into class and see sweatpants. Mm-mm. And people notice that very yes. clearly. So mm-hmm. I guess translate over to theater.
Absolutely. Maybe. Yeah, we had, let's see, when we did Wind Me Up Maria last fall, I was not the costume designer, but I was sort of watching the outside costume designer that the department had hired, who was a friend of mine, work with students, pick clothes to depict a Georgetown environment, which is really interesting. Because there were moments where I was like, oh, this character should really be a Vineyard Vines, you know, type wearer, you know, and that color of Nantucket red should be right on. And these things matter on this campus because people know. If we were doing it on another campus, it might, and we were like, oh, Georgetown, people's other outside expectations of Georgetown is like khakis and blue blazers, you know, and that the look is kind of conservative. I think people think from the outside, it's a bit like the business school sort of sets the fashion tone for what's yeah. outside Georgetown, because everyone's like, oh, well, the business students have to wear suits to class every day. Well, it's not true for the college, but then that's what people sort of see in the outside world, are all the interns that go to the Hill. And so that's Georgetown outside this campus, so that sets the reputation, I guess, visually. So it's just an interesting place to be, because, of course, on that, with another designer, I would keep my mouth closed. I'm like, I'm not going to offer my opinion, but I think that this wants to go in a slightly different direction than how you've dressed them. And it's just because we're looking at the Georgetown audience versus the Georgetown student.
So you're thinking, like, that interaction, not just with the student actors, but the student audience, mm-hmm. and, like, I don't know, maybe students, like, people from outside the campus, giving them a perception of our students. Mm-hmm. And it's like...
It's so many layers. It's like Inception. Because the actors are good. They will wear anything you ask them to. You know, like, it's not like the actors come in and fight about how they feel about the clothes. Like, they're like, okay, I'm comfortable, I can move, I'm happy, this feels like my character. Good. They're doing the work they're supposed to. But then their friends come to see the show, and I do wonder about the perception of our friends, who are like, that outfit, well, I mean, you look cute. Okay, I didn't see it as Georgetown, but all right, whatever. It's a very subtle thing, you know. My own undergrad, Middlebury, very distinctive uniform among the students when I was there. It was like the fleece vest. It was the 90s, so it was like fleece vest, long sleeve shirt, T-shirt, your North Face jacket on top of that, you know, Carhartt jeans, whatever. It was like brand based. And very sort of distinctive. Like, nobody messed around with, like, off-brand outdoor wear. It was Carhartt, L.L. Bean, North Face, you know, and other sort of brand name things. And if you weren't wearing that, it's not like people judged you, but it was different, which is awful. It's so economically based that it's it makes me feel kind of okay, but that's the truth.
Do you ever talk to the audience and ask them what they thought?
Yeah, often we'll get feedback. Usually it's casual feedback, or like The Voice or The Hoya will do like a review, you know. But yeah, I will ask the people who work for me, you know, what did your friends think of the show? Often they end up talking about like the plot, or I like this character, and then they're like, oh, the costume is just so beautiful, or you know, whatever it happens to be. But mm-hmm. I bet if you really dug in, the minutia would start coming out.
So, like, kind of like transitioning, I can like, that's how it is, like, working, like, the student body. Mm-hmm. What, can you tell us a little bit about your work off campus, like, sure. with the welders and mm-hmm. your projects and that?
Sure. So the current welders show, so the welders, gosh, this is so hard to explain. All right, the welders is a playwrights collective that is comprised at the present of 7 playwrights, and together every 6 months one of us will take over as essentially like artistic director, so leader of this group, and in that same time we will write and produce our own play. So this fall happens to be my tenure as artistic director, so I've spent the last I've spent the last 2 years working on this play, but then I've spent the last sort of 4 months getting organized, getting teams put together, revising the play, putting together a design team to produce. It is madness. And because I'm a designer, it's a little bit unusual, because like designer, playwright, different jobs, you'd think. But for me, I am working in the model of sort of designer as playwright, so the show is more visually driven and visually art driven than it is text driven.
Interesting.
So to explain, I have an ensemble of 8 actors who are brilliant, but then I also have sort of an ensemble of 4 designers that are working with me, and we're all working together to create kind of like a visual art installation in some ways. So like take this room that we're in, for example. If I wanted to create like a student center where, you know, you were publishing a newspaper out of, I might, you know, research rooms like this and then create, essentially recreate the room, but then also add some more stylized elements. Like I might cover the walls in old issues of the newspaper. So it's like part interior decoration and part stylized art, but it also, on top of that, is telling a theatrical story, and that is in service of the play that I'm trying to write, which is all about Korean adoptees trying to find home. So it's sort of a convoluted way to explain, like, there are actors in a room that looks like something that puts forward a story about these people.
So, like, looking at the play, do you almost, like, see it, like, told, like, in snapshots
yeah.
of how the positioning interplays with the costume set, so it's like, mm-hmm. that's really cool.
It's actually a great way to describe it. It is like a bunch of snapshots, because the biggest challenge in that, because we're not doing it in a traditional theater, we're doing it in a house. So the audience will walk from room to room to room. So in effect, they are getting snapshots. The biggest challenge of that is getting them to go from room to room. Like, they need a justification to be in the room, and they need a reason to feel welcome or not feel welcome. Then they need a justification to move to another room and do the same thing all over again. And so that's actually our very, very current challenge. Like, it's one of the things we'll be working on tonight is, so how do we get from here to there? How do you move 15 people at a time? You know, without being like, move, you have to go. You want to find the design, you know, the design reason for them to move. When you hear the sound, you move. Or when you see this light, you move.
That's interesting.
So, yeah, it is like turning a bunch of snapshots. But it's also creating a story. Because, I mean, yeah, a picture's worth 1,000 words. And they say words, too. But on the whole, for me, it is about the sort of storytelling of the individual. Like, I have a room. Here's an example. I have this woman who I'm calling the ultimate mother. She's the head of an adoption agency. And so behind her on the walls, there's like a giant collage of all the gifts that adoptees have come back to and given her over the years. So there's like one wall that's like 10 crosses, just a collection of them. There's another little section that's like birds. Then there's another selection of like Korean dolls, and there's a stack of Korean newspapers. So you realize, oh, I am in Seoul, and this woman is trying to get money out of me, and gifts, among other things, to add to her odd collection of stuff. So while it is a monologue and she's, like, trying to tell you things and tell you what you should do, it's also, you're seeing the visual story of, like, where she's come from and why she's there.
So it's, like, an image that's, like, representing her experience, like, mm-hmm. her also her life story in this, like, snapshot image.
Yep. It's, all it's in, so like, cool. a 7-minute scene. Yeah.
Wow. So how does being in D.C. influence your work or your perspective on fashion?
On fashion? D.C. is not known for its fashion as a city. I just read another very sad article about, like, Georgetown women. Not Georgetown University, but, like, Georgetown women setting the bar for D.C. fashion. Then I just got really sad because, like... In some ways, society, women in Georgetown, the fashion hasn't really changed since the 60s in terms of shape. You think of, like, society matrons outside of Georgetown, and, like, everything is based on the A-line dress with the high neckline without a lot of variation. It's variation in fabric, and, of course, they are following fashion, but in their own sort of staid boutique silhouette, you know? And this is, obviously, women of a certain economic background. But that is the stereotype, and there's a reason for that stereotype, because you go to society functions and you're like, oh, all the women here are in 100 variations on the same, like, 3 dresses. It's not a criticism, it's just a fact. Like, we are a political city, and the people that function outside of that sort of function in their own little pockets. I think of, like, there's amazing fashion up and around U Street. You go there on a weekend, and, like, the fashion is fresh, it's interesting, it's loud, and it doesn't apologize, and I love that. I find that exhilarating, but it's still not, that is never going to be Brooklyn, you know, like, we will never be New York City. But I think there's also a desire, like, we don't want to be New York City. We're D.C., we have our own sort of calling. So to be surrounded in that, at least in how it manifests itself in my work, I've done a lot of plays that are about DC and have DC characters. So knowing what all those styles and types are and where these women and men shop will inform how I dress a character. Because I'm like, oh, well, this needs to be a recognizable icon. Well, go back to Ann Taylor to shop for the 200th pair of pants, you know, for this character who is, like, a woman in her 30s trying to move up in the office but hasn't gotten that raise. You know, I mean, it's all these things. I try to think about where a character might go if they're a DC-based person. Because there are a ton of boutiques here that sell, like, really great clothes. But the clothing is all really expensive, so you have to be of a certain economic level before you would indulge in something like that.
Yeah, you've talked about how, like, how economics kind of play into this, mm-hmm. and I think of fashion as, like, often, like, a byproduct of history or mm-hmm. economics or society. How might fashion kind of drive politics or social change?
Mm-hmm. It's interesting. I'm actually really glad you sent me this question in advance, because I had to think about it, and I'm still like, oh, I'm still thinking. Two examples here. One is the pussy hats that came out during the Women's March. So I know a bunch of women who, like, they weren't sure they were going to go to the march, but they found the pussy hats, the pink crazy hats, yeah. the cat ears, you know, they found them very charming, and they're like, well, I'm going to make one of those, and then I think I'm going to go to the march, and as they were trying to decide, they're knitting these hats, and I think I'm part of a large knitting community. And so you saw, you know, in all the pictures, just these miles and miles of pink hats in, like, every shade of pink, and it was amazing, because that was sort of the symbol of that political movement, the descent to the election. And then now I see them, we'll probably see them again this winter. They'll pop back out when it gets cold again, because people are like, oh, I need a functional hat. But it's also a political statement that we will not forget anytime mm-hmm. soon. So while that's not leading the movement, it's a little bit more than a byproduct of the movement. I think it's one of those things that garment as political statement, you know, really becomes a focal point of, like, a recognizable movement. And we do a lot of that now with symbol in general. Like, I think about, like, all the Black Lives Matter signs. It's all about the signs, and now it's the action of taking a knee, but all those things are symbolic. They actually require very few words, which, as a designer, I'm looking at that and going, well, that's brilliant that they've chosen a visual symbol instead of, like, long, long speeches. There are obviously lots of people making long speeches about it, but the instantly recognizable thing will make people go, ah. And that is oddly related to fashion.
And then when you're wearing it, like, you're really taking, like, ownership of that.
You movie. Have like, to. Like, you can't ambivalently wear a pink pussy hat. You just can't. Because people are either going to come up to you and be like, hey, take that off your head, you jerk, you know, and other choice colorful words. Or they're going to be like, yeah, solidarity, because they understand exactly what you're for.
There's no way they're going to look at you and not see it. Like, it's a hat. It's, like, by your face. Like, you're looking someone in the eye, It's just there in front of you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, which is, if you're, like, wearing a shirt, and then someone has to, like, stare at your chest to read the shirt, it's a little more awkward. Like, a hat is just very present all the time.
And there's no words on it, like you said.
It's just a symbol and a color. Yeah. That's it. This is very simple. Second example I thought of, again, it's like, oh, you could argue that it's a byproduct. You could argue that it was the change that we needed to happen, and it affects DC fashion. Michelle Obama's arms were a giant subject, you know, six, 7 years ago. It was a big deal that she bought these dresses that exposed her arms. No first lady had done it before then. And granted, it helps that she was, like, the youngest first lady, and, like, her guns are impressive. She's a beautiful, statuesque, amazing woman with amazing arms. I'm so jealous. And so she'd wear these beautiful sleeveless sheath dresses and not apologize for it. She wouldn't cover up with a cardigan. I mean, sometimes she would if she knew she had to, but on the whole, she's bare-armed all the time, and critics, you know, they clucked their tongues, and they were like, that's not right, and that's not conservative enough for our DC. My eyes are assaulted because you broke this sartorial rule. But then all the stores picked up on it, less cardigans, more sleeveless dresses. I mean, it was, like, almost immediate in terms of their reaction. And I would say that a lot of those types of movements do come top down. A celebrity will do it, a first lady will do it. I'm sure that right now there is some woman, I don't know who it is right now, but I'm sure somebody is following Melania Trump's style and trying to replicate that. I don't know who. I am not a Republican. Someone is out there following that. And I think probably, well, she already made a giant faux pas with the shoes in Texas. The flooding, you know, so, like, people are watching. It's First Lady is a very vulnerable place to be, but
it could also be very empowering if you look at
style precedent.
I had no idea that Michelle Obama's arms made that much of a difference. I heard about it, but I thought it was because, like, people were admiring how healthy she was.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, I didn't know that, like, well, now you see on TV all these, like, CEOs that are portrayed as women, like, they all wear sleeveless dresses.
Right.
And they're all, like, bosses and very assertive.
Mm-hmm.
And I had no idea that wasn't a thing. Like,
no, it's a very, I would say it's a last decade kind of thing. In class, it's interesting. When I teach costume history, at the beginning, I ask everyone, what do you want to know? And they're like, well, I want to know what's happening now in current fashion. Like, what are we in now? Because every era has its own sort of personality, and we talk through all of those sort of personality changes and, like, why styles change, was it a monarch, and there's all sorts of insane stories that come down in history about, like, why a style changed. Someone, like, their feet, I think it was, like, Queen Elizabeth I, so Elizabethan England, loved her feet. They were small, they were petite, she had a good shoe collection, hemlines rose, and because her hemlines rose, everybody's hemlines rose, because everybody wanted to be like the queen. There was another story later in history, like, one of the kings, his hair got burnt from a candle or something, so he cut off his hair, and then all the nobles cut off their hair, and then everybody cut off their hair. So, anecdotal, but stuff like that happens all the time, and now because communication is moving so much faster, it's happening every day.
So, where are we now, then?
Where are we now? I know, we're like, we're in Michelle Obama's arms. I think we're still, I mean, I think we are in a women's empowerment fashion place right now. I think the movement towards unisex clothing or gender-neutral clothing is really beginning to sort of take flight, which is interesting because when I was teaching my class, it was just becoming a thing. This was like 3 years ago. And now I think it's in full swing. Like, we've had Uniqlo, but now it's taken off in the U.S. So, like, sort of Asian fashion styles, but all in very basic things. There's a store that somebody told me about in Georgetown that also had sort of free, you know, free size, free style, very unadorned and unshaped clothing. And I was like, well, that's an interesting choice, you know, that someone has made an entire boutique around sort of what we would describe as shapeless clothing. So I don't know. I'll be seriously interested to see where it goes. But I think we are moving into, like, what is gender? Let's question gender at the same time as we're looking at, like, super powerful women finally being able to dress like women without being shamed. You know, I mean, I hope that that's sort of where we are in the upswing.
It's so interesting because, like, fashion is so, like, kind of, like, geared towards women. Mm-hmm. Is the industry mostly made up of women, or even, like, theater and costume designing?
Yeah, it's interesting. Theater and costume design is about, well, I can't give you, like, perfectly factoid percentages, but I would say most of the designers I know are women or gay men. It's not really an industry for straight men. I don't know why. I guess maybe straight men aren't interested in clothes, but I know a few. Mm-hmm. But yeah, mostly it is women. The women that I know in the field, many of them are, and I think it's my generation right now. Many have just had children and are trying to figure out how to balance career and raising children. But then a lot of them also have sort of chosen to stay single and, or, you know, just with their partner and work all the time. That's sort of the choice that I've made. Like, I am married, but I don't have any kids. It is a choice. It's not the choice that many of my friends have made, but it is one of those, it's one of those things perceived sometimes as a problem in the industry because so many costume designers are women. Like, you wonder, oh, well, you're just coming here to make money and then you're going to leave the field and then maybe you'll come back later, or are you just going to have kids and leave? I think that's one of those questions in the field of theater generally, of, like, an actor will, you know, work in the field for 10 years, go off, get married, have a kid, not work for a couple years, come back, and maybe never work again because everybody forgot who they were. This is always the primal fear, I think, of artists, of, like, am I past my prime? Was I an ingenue in my 20s and I'm not allowed to play anything else? Maybe they won't get cast again until they're in their 40s.
So it's like a field of mostly women, and a woman still get discriminated in that sense. Mm-hmm.
Very much so.
Have any ideas of how that could change?
Women are banding together. I'm part of a giant Facebook group. I shouldn't disclose this. It's a secret group. I'll just say I'm part of a big secret group of women who all do DC theater. It's an amazing resource because people are able to have these conversations to be like, so it's everything from what kind of foundation do you like to am I ever going to work again, or will you look at my headshot, what is my type, or I'm looking for a monologue. It's mostly actors that are having these conversations, but at least women are now, you know, they're becoming friends with one another through this group, which I would say, at least from anecdotes of New York being a cutthroat place, you know, I think the theater scene here is a much friendlier group of people than it is competitive. Like, everyone knows who the five people in town who are their type because they see them at every audition. And I see, you know, I know the other 10 costume designers in this town. I know that we're all up for the same jobs. You just kind of say, well, that's okay. We might as well be friends. We might as well help each other out instead of being bitter enemies, because, like, what does that accomplish? Nothing. So I think in that way, maybe a whole bunch of people getting together and unifying a voice can make change. We're just in the beginning steps of an organization that we're now calling Not in Our House DC. There's currently a Not in Our House Chicago that is working towards creating guidelines for mostly non-equity theaters, so younger, non, like, professional, but not in the sort of upper echelon of theater, to create guidelines for essentially creating safe spaces against sexual harassment and racism and everything else that could go wrong in a space where we're not really policed by law. Working in theater is kind of a strange thing in terms of employment level, because generally small theaters don't have like HR departments who protect people. So I'm part of this group that's creating these guidelines to sort of say, hey, you should have, you know, more than two people in the room when you're doing a scene, you know, and you're negotiating like two people making out in a scene. It should be the director, the stage manager, maybe someone who is there as an intimacy director who's, you know, making sure that everybody is employing safe practices. No one's being a lech, because, like, that happens. You've heard about all the Harvey Weinstein stuff. That happens in theater. It's the ugly side that everyone kind of warns each other under the table about, but no one ever comes out and says it, because no one wants to not work ever again. Which, of course, you'd rather sort of out these people than people continually getting hurt. But that's what this organization is doing. So I think that is a big women-driven effort that's happening right now.
I mean, the past year or so, we've seen, like, a lot of very powerful men kind of...
come down.
Yeah. Yeah. Be outed for this kind of behavior. Do you think that's, like, a trend, or is it just a blip?
I don't know. Yeah, and now I'm thinking about Joss Whedon, which made me very sad. I mean, but even Joss Whedon is far from perfect. I think it's more than a blip. I think all it takes is one person to be like, hey, this stuff is bad, and we need to do something about it. That will then empower others to sort of pick up the ball and run. But I think people are always really afraid of the repercussions. Everyone's afraid of, like, not working again or being shamed for, you know, doing the right thing as much as they, you know, knew it would be a risk of their career. But I don't know, like, what, Glenn Close just stepped forward in this whole thing, and, like, Gwyneth Paltrow, the whole Harvey Weinstein thing. So I think this could be the beginning of a very large blip.
Because if we have that collective effort, like, they can't discriminate against certain people who are fighting what's been going on.
Mm-hmm.
Because if everyone's in that movement, like, they're only going to find people who are speaking out.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Or at least, hopefully that would be the goal, I guess.
I guess so. I do worry about the witch hunt, though. Like, I think about... It's interesting. So I only read the headline. Oh, such guilt. Donna Karan just defended Harvey Weinstein and said, oh, all these people are liars or something, and they're all coming forward. And I didn't read the article because I was afraid. But I was like, Donna Karan, why? You are a very powerful woman with a lot of influence. Like, why did you step backwards? But it does make me wonder, what does happen if the women do go on a super riot and it's not true? You know, not that I think women would lie, but I want to think the best of everybody, and it does get tricky when you get into these spaces of, like, you did speak out, and actually you spoke out because someone else said to you, this person did this thing, and then it just becomes rumor and conjecture versus the truth. I do worry about, you know, the men or the others that might affect down the road. I had a friend whose son was actually accused of sexual assault on campus, and he did not do it. I mean, says he, but I've known this kid for a very long time. There's no way. And so that is hard when you're weighing things like that, because of course I'm, any policies that will protect women against sexual assault and men against sexual assault, I want to put into place, and I want to see that be a really powerful thing on campuses, and I want to see all those perpetrators go away. But at the same time, like, what happens when an innocent person gets caught in that system? So I think we've got some work to do.
Yeah.
To keep it equitable.
I think we have to wrap up soon.
Sure thing.
Advice do you have for women going into the field of fashion or
costume design? That's a good question. I think my answer would have been different like a year ago. I would say in the moment, to not be pigeonholed as like just a costume designer. For me, the breakthrough that I've made in the past couple years is that, like, oh, I'm an artist. I have opinions beyond clothing. that I've been fortunate to exercise, but that as a costume designer, you're an artist first, and you can get caught up in the, like, domestics of it, because it's a job that's related to sewing and making things, and that is well and good, but you're not just Susie Little Homemaker sitting at home with your little sewing machine, like, making clothes for the boys, you know? It is a field where you're an artist first, and you have a voice, and you deserve a seat at the table with that voice. Yeah.
That's that.
Yeah,
it's definitely inspiring. Anything else to do?
No, I think I'm good. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you so much for coming. That was, I learned so much about fashion and design I never would have considered. Like, next time I see a show, I'm going to be watching for all these little things.
There you go.
How for the details. Anyway, I'd like to thank everyone who listened to us today, and I'd like to invite you to follow us on Twitter at GTownVoice or at HalftimeGU. My Twitter is at MLEJaster.
Mine is at KAEI_LI.
And you can also find these podcasts on the GeorgetownVoice.com, that is. And you can subscribe on iTunes to the Voice Podcast Network.
Thank you so much.